Michael Lippmann is a former rugby international who played 10 test matches for England before playing professionally for Bristol and Bath and then joining the Melbourne Rebels. In that sporting career, he was concussed 30 times, eventually retiring from the game as a result. Then came the devastating diagnosis 2 years ago that Michael has chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE, and early onset dementia. Michael Lippmann is one of the initial group of former players to take a concussion lawsuit against World Rugby. Those leading the lawsuit on behalf of 225 former players, including some New Zealanders, last week said the serving of proceedings against World Rugby and other governing bodies was imminent. Michael and his wife Frankie have written a book detailing how his traumatic brain injuries have impacted his and their lives and making the case for urgent changes to concussion protocols in contact sports. It's simply called concussion. Michael Lippmann is with us now from Australia. Michael, thanks very much for your time.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's an honour to be on here. Thank you.
Michael, born in England, raised in Sydney, a rugby star from a young age, you played the sport with full passion and joy, right?
Oh, yeah. No, I certainly left everything out there on the field.
You're a flanker, and again, I think you call them breakaway, don't you, often in Aussie, and this is a position where a lot of freedom.
Yeah, well, you're a back and a forward, but I think during my school days it was breakaway, but then, you know, when I left in 1998, it was sort of transferring to flanker, yeah.
It wasn't long into your career when you started getting concussions and, you know, something like 200 games, I think, and a staggering number with what we know now of concussions. But how were they handled at the time, Michael?
It depends, I guess, on the severity of the concussion. You know, if it was a very mild concussion or, you know, a fairly moderate concussion or a substantial concussion, obviously it was handled differently. If you got a full concussion, which is probably the most relevant that we're talking about at the moment, it basically was handled by the physios just coming up to you while you're lying on the ground saying, you know, who are we playing, what day is it, and what's the score? So if you can get those three answers right, you were able to carry on. And if you had a full concussion and you were getting carried off the field, you were able to play the next week.
Were you as a player thinking about this then, or did you just trust the medics and the authorities to make good decisions? Because you were a hard man player, right?
Well, I think it's a bit of a balance between knowing yourself and knowing your limits, and then taking their advice on board and simply just going from there, because concussion wasn't talked about. It wasn't a huge subject at the time. And you do have to trust the medics, but, you know, you want to advance your career as best you can. So you always wanted to play on the next week. You didn't want to let the team down. And it was very hard to get players like myself off the field.
Understood. You've played some games you've had absolutely no memory of. I think when you were playing for England against the All Blacks, that's a match, one of the matches you just can't remember.
Oh, that's one of a hell of a lot. And it's unfortunate, you know, like, 'cause when you're playing against the teams like the All Blacks and the Wallabies and, you know, all those European countries, it's such a shame, because I'd love to be able to remember those moments, because they were very special moments for me. And something that I'd really love to be able to explain and show the, you know, my son Joey later on in his future. But yeah, it is such a shame.
Really important in your story as well is this wasn't just at the international level. Even at high school, when you were playing for a proud rugby school, there were days where you would feel dazed or dizzy after many games, right? And at that level, at that time, just very little action taken. Was that the case?
There was no action taken, unfortunately. I didn't have a major concussion while I was at school. I went through a hell of a lot of sub-concussions or mild concussions, and that just they just act as like a dripping tap. So obviously the more of the tap goes, the greater the risk. So yeah, unfortunately it wasn't really talked about or handled, even from a young age.
Michael, you retired from football and you began working in real estate. And by this stage, were you already experiencing some of the problems that were to grow?
So I certainly was. I just wasn't aware, because when you're a rugby player, you're always thinking, oh, I'm a rugby player and I'll be fine. You've got the too proud attitude on, in your head. And if someone pulls you up and saying, look, I think you've got some issues with your brain, you're always in denial and you just put it off. So I didn't know I had issues going on in my head, and I was acting just, totally different to what I would normally do, but I just wasn't aware. So during my real estate career, I excelled in the first 2 or 3 years really well, and then it just went down. After a few years of the symptoms just getting worse and worse.
Struggling to remember names and do some of the details. And you're very honest in the book about so many things, and thank you for that because it's such an important topic. But alcohol became an issue around this time as well. It just is what is a means to cope with whatever the hell was going on.
Yeah, because you didn't understand, the alcohol just made it that little bit better, because whatever you got through the day, you could always sort of reward yourself, at the end of the day by having a few glasses of wine. And it's just masking how you feel. So it doesn't do anything other than magnify, sorry, electrify your symptoms by drinking, but it also takes away sort of any feelings that you've got regarding yourself, or because you're in denial all the time, you're just like, oh, I'm just going to forget it. And alcohol certainly helped at the time.
You met the wonderful Frankie in 2016. It was a pretty whirlwind relationship between the two of you.
Yeah, I don't know how she does it, I don't know, because we had an amazing first few years together. We were so in love and we had a great honeymoon, and then all of a sudden my symptoms just overtook me, and Frankie just could not understand what was going on. So after living with me and, monitoring me and my behavior after a certain amount of time, she just said, look, you need to get checked out. And unfortunately, at that stage, it was like, you got to decide between, did you want a family life or do you want to be by yourself? Because the way I was going at that time, she was going in the other direction. She was, ready to walk out. But she stuck by me and we made some changes, and that's the best outcome that I could have hoped for.
There were things happening again that were concerning everybody, things that hadn't happened that you thought had, and vice versa. And then there were other really physical impacts, insomnia, chronic headaches, etc. What was this prompt to actually start investigating medically, Michael?
In 2014, I started to get severe migraines. So my GP sent me to see a neurologist, and then he got rid of the headaches by putting me on an antidepressant, which treats anxiety, depression, and all that in one go. But that was resolved very, very quickly. So I thought, great, my job's done. Well, the testing's done. I don't need anything else because I'm young, I'm fit, I'm proud, nothing's wrong with me. The headaches are gone. However, probably 4 years later, and that between 2014 and 2018, they were the worst years of my life in terms of my behavior. But it was then in 2018 or 2019 when we started to get some testing done.
Again, you're really honest in the book about the impacts on you, and you were having nighttime seizures that had, impacts for you, incontinence, for example. And this is really personal stuff, but really powerful for letting people inside the stress you must have been under, the stress your relationship was under, and also the not knowing. Who was able to give you clear answers, Michael?
A neurologist, and the people in your life, really, because the people in your life that know you and see you spiral out of control, is really, really it's confronting, but it's also great to hear, great to see, because you do have some answers for your bizarre, crazy behavior. You know, having those incontinence issues, having, you know, almost burning the house down, doing all these little things is just such a, you know, huge impact on yourself. You know, Frankie, during the time of writing the book and all that, she, you know, she undergoed like two miscarriages. You know, we had argument after argument. You know, I was very reluctant to write the book, and then it didn't take me too long to sort of say to myself, right, it's no longer about you, Michael. It's now about the future, and the future of rugby union, and the future of our kids and their kids, and make sure that, you know, they love the sport and they want to play hard, but at the same time, they need to ensure that they're 100% okay to return to play.
Michael Lipman is our guest. With his wife Frankie, he's co-written Concussion, A Family Story. You're listening to 9 to Noon on RNZ National. So you were contacted by a UK lawyer about being part of this lawsuit against World Rugby and some other rugby unions. And how important was it on the emotional journey you were on to know that you weren't alone and that there were others dealing with this?
Yeah, to feel that sense of, united people, you know, that are on the sort of same wavelength frame-wise, it was very, very nice to hear. I mean, there's a man named Alex Popham who sent me a message via Instagram, and he just said, explaining me exactly those details regarding a potential lawsuit and that, and I totally forgot who he was. And I put it off for 6 months until I actually responded to him. And I said, sorry, who are you? Are you a player? Are you a fan? Are you a journalist? And then he sent me his profile and went, oh, my God, you're Alex Popham. Yes, I know exactly who you are. Okay, great. And then we exchanged numbers. And then I spoke to our solicitor and literally just went from there.
There's a very clear purpose to this. We've spoken to others as well. There's a very clear purpose to this lawsuit. Part of it is about supporting those living with this, but a large part is about bringing change to the sport. What do you believe would make a difference? What changes?
Number one, the players, and the players need to be honest within themselves. And I think hiring an independent neurologist who has no ties to the coaching or medical staff or the team, and literally is out there just to assess simply for concussions, and with that doesn't bring any, you know, issues surrounding coaches or management saying get him back on the field, and, you know, when can he play, and there's pressure, you know, those sorts of things need to change. And also to make it mandatory time during contact training throughout the week. At the moment, it's recommended that they have mandatory time, but it's not enforced. So having less contact training sessions during the week will really, really help all players in the future moving forward. You know, the number one thing is we don't want people to be, you know, having any fear going into rugby or playing rugby union. Yeah, because concussions are going to happen, no matter we like it or not. You know, we really want the player and the medical staff to be truly honest with themselves before they return to play. Because the hardest thing about concussion is that you can't see it. You can only feel it. And that's a very, very difficult thing to treat.
There's talk about removing contact and contact training full stop. I think some teams or unions are moving to that. I don't know how viable that's perceived to be as a means of preparing for matches at the top level, Michael.
Yeah, I mean, you've at some stage during the week, you've got to have a level of, you've got to have contact. You've got to do a session, either, even if it's for 10 minutes. You have to have that contact during the week to prepare you. Now that is normal, but unless that time is mandatory, people and coaches and players, they're gonna get straight into contact training straight away. I mean, you've got players that want to keep their position, but you've also got players in the squad that want to get their position. So it becomes pretty challenging, especially at test match level. If this person has your number on their on the field and he's performing, you want to go and get it. So it's very hard to make sure that no contact training sessions actually turn into contact sessions. So it really needs to be enforced.
Michael, do you have any comment on the current tackle laws or the current style of game that is being played? Because you would have grown up probably with around the ankles tackling initially. These days, it seems to be very much a full frontal body blow. I know there has been moves to a tightening up to try and prevent the head-to-head collisions and tackling. But is there room to look at the rules around that body contact in the tackles in particular?
Yeah, it's a great question. Generally, when concussions occur, is a very spur of the moment reaction or action, and it could be done at a ruck, could be done in a tackle, could be done carrying the ball. And look at the way the game is going at the moment, and the intensity of it. I mean, everyone's getting faster, bigger, stronger. It's concussions are going to happen. So, in terms of the training, and the coaching methods throughout the week or from a young age, I think we really need to focus on, yeah, we need to focus on tackling as we did back in the day, which was around your ankles. But unfortunately, that just it's not the combat that we're seeing at the moment, and it's very, very hard to change. I mean, the post-concussion protocols will continue to evolve over time, and it's very hard to find that balance or solution to the problem. But I think the only thing you can control is how the player is monitored and treated after a concussion, and their return to play needs to be 100% perfectly fine with that player and that independent neurologist.
Just finally, Michael, like the latest we heard from the lawyers leading the lawsuit was that they were intending to lodge proceedings next week. This is drawn out because, as we said, a large part of the motivation is explained to me is to try and get the rugby authorities to get moving. And there's frustration that they've not moved far enough, fast enough. But there's one other point, which is that you face financial difficulties when you couldn't do your new job anymore. And there are many others living with quite high needs and financial consequences of the injuries they had in the service of this game. Do you believe World Rugby and other authorities also need to move on better supports for those living with these conditions?
Yeah, I think Dylan Hartley actually brought it up. He's the ex-England captain, and I read one of his articles, and he said it would be great if all the players throughout their career just donated 1% of their contract amount, and they put it in a fund to look after players such as, ourselves, who literally can't hold down a position because you can't communicate properly, or you're going to lose your frustration. You've got all those issues surrounding head trauma, and they can't earn a living and provide for their family. So you can go down a few avenues of trying to get government support, but when you've got a family and a roof and bills and everything over your head, it's hard. So I think those sorts of strategies surrounding like a pool of money, either if it's in held in Rupa or the Australian Rugby Union, the Players Rugby Union. Look, I think if the players went about that and said, "Look, I really care about the potential of, our game, and I want to make sure that all the players are okay after their playing day." So there's a pool of 1% of everyone's individual contracts, and that would be a great strategy moving forward.
Michael, thank you, and thanks also to Frankie for the generosity and the honesty and everything else that has gone into this very personal book. Thanks for your time too. Michael Lipman has co-authored with his wife Frankie Lipman, Concussion.